today, the Reagan administration has updated liberationism to apply to 1980s crisis points like Angola and Nicaragua. The CIA, with the president's backing, is now spending in excess of $600 million per year to equip some 80 to 100,000 anti-communist, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, with arms, supplies, and even state-of-the-art Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. This renewed Cold War strategy, sometimes known as the Reagan Doctrine, has also become a litmus test of conservative Republican orthodoxy, writes Washington Post political analyst Sidney Blumenthal, B-L-U-M-E-N-T-H-A-L. Right-wing true believers have taken to using votes on funding for, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, like Angolan rebel strongman Jonas Savimbi, S-A-V-I-M-B-I, as a means of extracting concessions from Republican moderates and driving their party farther to the right. The new liberationist goal, Blumenthal writes, again quoting, is to ensure that no Republican will be nominated for president who has not pledged fealty to their ideology, unquote. The liberation ideal, quote, permanent counter-revolution, unquote, in Blumenthal's words, meaning protracted conflict with the USSR leading to a final showdown in which communism is wiped from the face of the earth, is not simply a, quote, Nazi idea, unquote, nor is it appropriate to label people who support it Nazis or Nazi sympathizers. This last sentence again, because it's important, it is a very important and accurate statement, and it may be the people are misunderstanding my identifying everyone who believes in this liberation theory as Nazis. That's not true. The point is, as Simpson goes on to document, and as we've talked about, it is the idea that it has its genesis with the Third Reich. Again, the liberation ideal, permanent counter-revolution, unquote, in Blumenthal's words, meaning protracted conflict with the USSR, leading to a final showdown in which communism is wiped from the face of the earth, is not simply a, quote, Nazi idea, unquote, nor is it appropriate to label people who support it Nazis or Nazi sympathizers. I would interject, of course, obviously many of them who do are both Nazis and or Nazi sympathizers. The Post's Blumenthal, for example, continuing with Simpson's text, attributes many of Burnham's liberationist theories to Burnham's flirtation with Trotskyism in the 1930s. But the fact remains, as Simpson writes here, that ideas and theories have histories just as nations do. They are the products of particular circumstances and junctures in civilization. Burnham's theories were based on his work with exiles during the early years of the American Committee for Liberation, Radio Liberation from Bolshevism, and similar projects that enlisted numerous Nazi collaborators among that generation of, quote, freedom fighters, unquote. Burnham speaks highly of Germany's political warfare in Bielorussia and the Ukraine. The last sentence again. Burnham speaks highly of Germany's political warfare in Bielorussia and the Ukraine. It was only Hitler's later blunders that made its Eastern Front policy a mistake, he writes in Containment or Revolution. The true origins of liberationism as a coherent philosophy lie in Nazi Germany and in the Nazis' political warfare campaign on the Eastern Front and nowhere else. Again, I would note, perhaps somewhat ironically, Simpson says that it's not fair to label liberationism as a Nazi idea, nor all of its advocates as Nazis or Nazi sympathizers, and yet, here we have Burnham saying that basically it was only Hitler's later blunders that made its Eastern Front policy a mistake. He writes in Containment or Revolution, and again, the true origins of liberationism as a coherent philosophy lie in Nazi Germany and in the Nazis' political warfare campaign on the Eastern Front and nowhere else. And as we shall see as we progress into tonight's installment, the putting into effect of the basic principles of NSC 68, and bear in mind that as we've already looked at, indeed Nazis and Nazi sympathizers are front and center in the RHGC, the Republican Heritage Group's Council, we'll see many of these same elements and even some of the same individuals, such as Laszlo Pastor, projected directly into resurgent activity in the former Soviet Union or Eastern Europe, and at least some of those elements in places like Croatia and the Ukraine and Lithuania have apparently achieved political dominance. Although the elements are resurgent, the jury is still out on the degree of dominance that some of them will achieve. Some of them, though, are obviously dominant in the areas, in some of their relevant areas. We're going to return again to The Enemy Within, The U.S. Economy, The Enemy Within, by Doug Henwood, his article on NSC 68. And we're going to review a couple of the principles of NSC 68. Reviewing Doug Henwood's text, NSC 68, again, provided for a massive U.S. military buildup to prime the U.S. economic pump using a sort of military Keynesianism to stimulate the world economy, to break the back economically of the Soviet Union, and also, as we shall see, to stimulate nationalism, unquote, to help dissolve the Soviet Union and break away its satellites. And bear in mind, too, that one of the provisions for NSC 68 was a mass propaganda campaign to build and maintain confidence on our side. Those quotes, that was the mass propaganda campaign which NSC 68 author Paul Nitze endorsed, and that was the campaign under which the CFF's projection of liberation thinking and individuals, or exponents, into the American political system took place. Now, quoting from NSC 68, from the Doug Henwood article, quote, if a dynamic expansion of the economy were achieved, unquote, the memo suggested, the necessary buildup could be accomplished without a decrease in the national standard of living, unquote. The arms buildup, then, could help solve in ideologically convenient terms the characteristic crisis of U.S.-style capitalism. But an arms buildup would hurt the USSR, which was already, quote, being drawn upon close to the maximum possible extent, unquote, thereby leaving it even more vulnerable to its characteristic crisis, that of chronic shortage. This economic squeeze was one front in the strategy of containment which, rather than a doctrine of resisting expansion, the public explanation, was actually a, quote, calculated and gradual coercion, unquote, to, as an earlier memo quoted in NSC 68 put it, quote, reduce the power and influence of the USSR. Well, we're going to take a look now at something that we went into at great length and considerable detail in Radio Free America program number 36, the destabilization of the USSR and Eastern Europe, namely the Reagan full-court press strategy of destabilizing the Soviet Union, and how this represents a fulfillment of the tactics enunciated and formulated in NSC 68. We're going to turn again. Now, bear in mind that the next few elements of tonight's installment of RFA 37 are recapitulating elements from RFA 36. I'm not going to go into the detail or length that I went into at RFA 36. People interested in this are strongly encouraged, if they do not have it, to get a hold of Radio Free America number 36, the destabilization of the USSR and Eastern Europe, for a complete discussion of these events. We're turning again to Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 35 from the fall of 1990. And again, we're going to take a look at the massive Reagan military buildup as the fulfillment of NSC 68. And again, this is in response to the greatly exaggerated estimates of Soviet military power that were produced by Team B, including Richard Pipes, who we're going to look at here, the General Daniel Graham, of Star Wars Advocacy, and Paul Nitze, the original architect of NSC 68. And bear in mind that the Team B tactics involving William Casey and George Bush were basically strongly reminiscent and evolved from the Galen exaggerated accounts of Soviet military capabilities and political intentions, which basically served as the pretext for and interacted with Paul Nitze and the other people behind NSC 68, which again involved the CFF program in the United States, resulting in the projection of liberation thinking and exponents into the political American political mainstream. This particular article, again dealt with at greater length and in more detail in RFA 36, is from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35 from the fall of 1990. It is headlined, or entitled, I should say, A Full Court Press: The Destabilization of the Soviet Union, and it's authored by Sean Gervasi, G-E-R-V-A-S-I, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Observers in the West and in the socialist bloc have, on the whole, seriously misunderstood the foreign and military policies pursued by the U.S. during the last decade. These have been depicted as uneven and reckless because most analyses have focused on surface phenomena such as the expansion of military forces or efforts to deny the Soviet Union new technologies rather than on the strategy behind such policies. This strategy now needs to be examined and debated for two reasons. Firstly, it appears to have achieved a considerable measure of success. This is not generally recognized, particularly among critics of the Reagan administration from the center to the left. Conservatives, however, are openly arguing that the Reagan administration set in motion the policies which led to, quote, the defeat of communism, unquote. The editor of Policy Review, the flagship publication of the Heritage Foundation, wrote recently that the West had, quote, won, unquote, the Cold War because of the foreign policies pursued by conservative governments in every major country of the Western world, unquote. And again, take note of this. Actually, no, there's no quote at the end of that. This is the Policy Review publication by the Heritage Foundation, founded by Paul Weyrich, who also founded the Free Congress Foundation, which we're going to look at in just a few minutes. But we can see in this the reflection of the Christian West concept. The editor of Policy Review, the flagship publication of the Heritage Foundation, wrote recently that the West had, quote, won, unquote, the Cold War because of the foreign policies pursued by conservative governments in every major country of the Western world. Again, sort of a reflection of the Christian West. By the way, I would note, too, that when I first analyzed a number of articles that we're going to recapitulate to a certain extent in this archive show in Radio Free America 36, which I did in the late winter and early spring of 1991, the Soviet coup had not yet taken place, the failed coup of August of 1991. I predicted that coup, although I felt that it would lead to a return to Stalinism and the Cold War. It was obvious that the Soviet Union was both infiltrated and being destabilized, but I did not guess that it would fall apart like a wet paper bag. I don't know of anyone outside of the people actually involved in the destabilization who could have accurately assessed that. But this article was written before the Soviet coup, and I predicted that coup as the goal of U.S. covert operations against the Soviet Union. Continuing here with Gervasi's analysis. David Rubenstein, R-U-B-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, a sociologist at the University of Illinois, was more specific. Quote, the key difference in Soviet policy between the 1970s and the 1980s, he wrote, again quoting, is to be explained not by further deterioration of the Soviet economy, but in changes in U.S. foreign policy, unquote. I would add that there was further deterioration of the Soviet economy produced, in fact, by changes in U.S. policy. And Gervasi goes into that. Secondly, there is substantial evidence that having succeeded in aggravating the crisis in the Soviet Union, the U.S. and its allies are now engaged in building internal pressures there for further reforms. They are engaged in open, large-scale interference in the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. Conservative analysts are open about this. Rubenstein, for instance, expressed his concern that, quote, if the current sense of crisis is eased, the motivation for further reform may be lost, unquote. And he concluded that, again, quoting, if internal pressure was a key factor in motivating this policy of reform, pressure may be required to keep it moving forward, unquote. One of the first public indications of the existence of a secret strategy to apply pressure against the Soviet Union came in March of 1981. Richard Pipes, a senior National Security Council official in charge of Soviet affairs, gave a press interview which caused some controversy. Pipes, a Soviet expert on leave from Harvard University, told a Reuters correspondent that, quote, nothing was left of détente, unquote. Furthermore, he said, the new administration might soon pursue a foreign policy, quote, as radical as the new president's economic program, unquote. Now, again, Richard Pipes, the NSC's top expert on Soviet affairs, a key member of Team B, along with NSC 68 author Paul Nitze, Daniel Graham, and others, formed again by George Bush and William Casey. Continuing, and again, this is the Team B analysis, reflective of the Galen misestimates and their effects on American society and the military buildup of NSC 68, it was the Team B analysis which set the stage for the huge military buildup in the Reagan-Bush years and the resulting destabilization and eventual dissolution of the Soviet Union. Continuing here with Gervaisi's account. The Reagan administration, he told the interviewer, was moving towards a strategy of confrontation with the Soviet Union and with radical and socialist regimes in the Third World. The purpose of the strategy, Pipes indicated, was to change the world balance of forces in favor of the U.S. and its allies. The key sentence in the Pipes interview was, quote, "Soviet leaders would have to choose between peacefully changing their communist system in the direction followed by the West and going to war," unquote. And the New York Times described Pipes as saying that, quote, "there was no alternative to war with the Soviet Union if the Russians did not abandon communism," unquote. These words did not come from a middle-level government official. They came from the senior National Security Council officer in charge of Soviet affairs, and they were, for that reason exactly, seen as indicating a dangerous aggressiveness on the part of the Reagan administration. The Pipes interview rang alarm bells around the world. The White House immediately disavowed the interview, claiming that Pipes' remarks, quote, did, quote, not represent the views of the administration, unquote. Even so, U.S. allies protested vigorously. The Financial Times of London warned that U.S. allies would be angered by any attempt to play what it called, quote, a dangerous game of chicken, unquote. By the way, I would interrupt here before we continue with Gervaisi's account. Pipes himself is of Polish. He was born in Poland. This, by the way, should not be interpreted as being xenophobic or in any way a negative reflection on Polish Americans, but rather one of the effects of the Galen organization and its related elements was to project exiles from not only the elements of the various republics of the former Soviet Union proper, but also from Warsaw Pact countries into American political life. Zbigniew Brzezinski, for example, was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He was born in Poland. He also was very active with Galen-related elements in Radio Free Europe, including Paul Henze, former CIA station chief in Europe. He was preceded as national security advisor by Henry Kissinger, who obviously was born in Germany. And Kissinger, interestingly enough, served in World War II with the 970th Counterintelligence Corps, which recruited many of the top Third Reich people who eventually moved into the Galen organization, including, among others, SS commando trainer and Third Reich favorite, Hitler favorite, I should say, Otto Skorzeny, who went to work for Galen, and the notorious war criminal Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, as well. Later, as documented in The Belarus Secret by John Loftus, Henry Kissinger went to work for the Pentagon on a program to revive the collaborationist networks inside of the Soviet Union in the event of a Third World War. Those networks, obviously, were Galen networks. This by way of taking a look at the level to which Galen-related elements or elements influenced by the policies that the Galen organization helped to institute in combination with its sympathizers and allies inside the United States, the level to which some of these elements rose. People like Polish-born Brzezinski, Polish-born Pipes, German-born Kissinger moved to the highest echelons of the U.S. government without having been born in the United States as a result of the general phenomena that we're looking at here. And again, I'm not in any way casting aspersions on German Americans or Polish Americans or suggesting that Pipes is a Nazi. Obviously, he was a hard-tailed cold warrior and basically someone in the Galen mold of thinking, not necessarily a Nazi himself. Continuing now with Gervaisi's account, "Then the storm fell as suddenly as it had arisen, and nothing more was heard of the matter," that is the inflammatory rhetoric by NSC Soviet Affairs Specialist Richard Pipes, a member of Team B. "In retrospect," writes Gervaisi, "it seems likely that Pipes was being used deliberately to alarm the Soviets so that they would try to match the U.S. military expansion then underway, particularly in the nuclear field. The Pipes, quote, leak, unquote, is entirely consistent with a strategy of, quote, spending them into bankruptcy, unquote, unquote, or, quote, weakening Russia's economy, unquote." Those quotes from a Rand Corporation paper from October of 1985. The strategy itself, however, involved much more than the threat of nuclear war. A large number of studies by the RAND Corporation carried out in the early 1980s shed considerable light on the wider strategy and made it clear that the Reagan administration was not preparing for war, but mounting a, quote, sophisticated attack on the Soviet economy. The RAND Corporation is a California think tank which carries out a great deal of classified research, especially for the military. Its experts move in and out of government, and it is routinely asked to analyze and comment upon military and intelligence planning documents which are not accessible to an ordinary congressman. RAND, like a number of similar organizations, is in effect a part of the military intelligence complex. Many of the RAND studies in question were commissioned by the Department of Defense, and the published papers were often, quote, sanitized, unquote, versions of classified studies. The titles of the papers themselves were suggestive. They included, quote, economic leverage on the Soviet Union, unquote, the costs of the Soviet Empire, unquote, sitting on bayonets, the Soviet defense burden, and Moscow's economic dilemma, unquote. Taken together, these papers were essentially concerned with two issues. The first was, quote, economic stringency, unquote, in the Soviet Union, especially from the late 1970s. The second was what measures NATO countries could use to make that, quote, economic stringency, unquote, more acute. And again, the NATO countries, we're talking about the Christian West. These papers, moreover, developed a clear analytical line of argument which may be summarized as follows. Economic growth in the Soviet Union had begun to slow in the late 1970s, increasing the difficulties of meeting the various claims on resources. At the same time, the Soviet Union was entering a, quote, leadership crisis as leadership of the Communist Party was being passed to a younger generation. The United States and its allies could take various actions which would force the Soviet Union to increase its defense spending and its economic and military assistance to allies and friends. They could also take measures to deny the Soviet Union access to credits, key imports, and modern technology, which is especially important for increasing productivity and accelerating growth. Such measures would either reduce the overall volume of resources available to the Soviet Union, hold back the growth of productivity, or force resources to be shifted from domestic consumption and investment. Each of these effects would aggravate the difficulties confronting the Soviet leadership in a stagnant economy. A combination of measures, quote, to impose costs, unquote, on the Soviet Union might be expected to lead to a fall in investment and or living standards. A combination of such measures, consequently, might generate pressures within the Soviet Union for withdrawing from the world stage and for political and economic reforms. Thus, the RAND studies seem to be preparing the groundwork for a kind of hot-cold war aimed at weakening and possibly even breaking the back of the Soviet economy. In the 1980s, after a decade of détente, this was remarkable enough in itself. It is clear, however, that analysts believe the ultimate aim of this strategy should be to force change upon the Soviet Union. Thus, the Reagan administration sees Soviet economic troubles as an opportunity to complicate, this is a quote, by the way, thus the Reagan administration sees Soviet economic troubles as an opportunity to complicate further their resource allocation dilemma in the hope that additional pressure would result in a reallocation of resources away from defense or would push the economy in the direction of economic and political reforms. And the next section of Gervaisi's article, The Reagan Doctrine, a Full Court Press. The fact that the RAND Corporation and other think tanks were in the early years of the last decade studying the possibilities of the strategy in question does not prove that the Reagan administration ever adopted such a strategy. However, in mid-1982, evidence began to emerge that the Reagan administration had actually adopted precisely the kind of policy which RAND had been studying and which Pipes had referred to. In May of 1982, a second White House official, a consultant to the National Security Council, met with a small group of reporters to give a background briefing. The subject was U.S. policy towards the Soviet Union. According to one reporter, the White House official outlined an extremely aggressive policy, and his remarks actually alarmed some of those present. Helen Thomas, the UPI White House correspondent, sent a dispatch about the meeting which contained the following passage. A senior White House official said Reagan approved an 8-page national security document that undertakes a campaign aimed at internal reform in the Soviet Union and the shrinkage of the Soviet Empire. He reaffirmed that it could be called, quote, a full-court press, unquote, against the Soviet Union. And more about this full-court press, skipping down in the article, William Clark, then Reagan's national security advisor, hinted at the existence of a full-court press at the time that the defense guidance document was leaked to the New York Times. Speaking at Georgetown University on May 20, 1982, he described emerging U.S. strategy as including, quote, diplomatic, economic, and international components built on a foundation of military strength, unquote. Clark was saying that Cold War rhetoric, policies toward East-West trade, quote, public diplomacy, unquote, rearmament, etc., were all connected, all part of an overall plan. And he indicated that this strategy had a new purpose, quote, we must force our principal adversary, the Soviet Union, to bear the brunt of its economic shortcomings, unquote. And skipping down, according to Gene Kirkpatrick, the Reagan Doctrine included the following important components. Quote, rebuilding defenses, that is, expansion of U.S. military forces. Quote, developing new defenses, unquote, including the Strategic Defense Initiative. Recall that Daniel Graham was a key advocate of that. We're going to touch back on the SDI, so hold that in mind. Quote, development and deployment of advanced weapons in the U.S. and Europe, unquote. Withholding, quote, from our adversaries advanced technology of military importance, unquote. Quote, support for freedom fighters, unquote, that is, low-intensity war and proxy war. Propaganda, or what Kirkpatrick called a response at the ideological level to, quote, semantic infiltration, unquote, and moral disarmament. A foreign assistance program that would, quote, utilize aid to expand and preserve freedom. Skipping down again. The typical campaign of destabilization, now here we're going to turn from the economic pressure, again, massive military spending to break the back of the Soviet Union, the fulfillment of what was first proposed in NSC 68 by Paul Nitze, a member of Team B, which led directly to the Reagan military buildup. Now we're going to turn to the destabilization of the Soviet Union through internal covert action. The typical Gervaisi writes, the typical campaign of destabilization has involved two elements. The first is external pressure, the second is internal manipulation. The attacker is bent on creating disruption and turmoil in the target country, but that is only its first objective. The ultimate purpose is to produce political change, typically a change of government, a coup d'etat, or even a revolution. There can be no assurance, however, that disruption and turmoil will produce the desired political results. Therefore, in most cases, the attacking power also intervenes in the internal political process in the target country. Now we're going to take a look. Now bear in mind here those couple of sentences. The ultimate purpose is to produce political change, typically a change of government, a coup d'etat, or even a revolution. There can be no assurance, however, that disruption and turmoil will produce the desired political results. Therefore, in most cases, the attacking power also intervenes in the internal political process in the target country. Skipping down, we're going to take a look at the destabilization effort inside of the Soviet Union, and we went into this at considerable length in Radio Free America 36. And one of the things that we went into in an addendum to RFA 36 done earlier in 1992, taking a follow-up article by Sean Gervaisi on the full-court press strategy, the National Endowment for Democracy, one of the major vehicles for political interference inside of the Soviet Union, was an above-board organization. And what Gervaisi is going to talk about here is basically the transition of destabilization process from covert to overt operations, and that synthesis, again, of political, economic, and national security life is basically what we looked at in NSC 68, the Christian West concept as applied to the United States. Skipping down in Gervaisi's article, it is not possible here to examine the many means which the West has used to manipulate the internal situation in socialist countries over the last 8 years, but they have been numerous. Obviously, throughout this period, intelligence agencies in the West have been highly active inside the socialist countries, although very little has been written or reported on the subject. So it is difficult to know what effect covert actions have had on the situation. What is striking today, however, is that so many public agencies and private organizations are doing exactly what intelligence agencies have done in the past. Again, what is striking today, however, is that so many public agencies and private organizations are doing exactly what intelligence agencies have done in the past. Government agencies, foundations, business groups, media organizations, human rights groups, trade unions, and others are all supporting and aiding opposition groups, particularly in the Soviet Union. They are openly aiding and guiding forces hostile to socialist governments. They are, in short, actively working to produce that, quote, internal transformation, unquote, of which Pipes spoke 6 years ago. One has only to read the documents of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, the Department of State, and the U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy to understand the scale of this intervention. And just as we have the veteran intelligencer, William Casey, directing Ronald Reagan's campaign, he then becomes CIA director. We have the former director of the CIA, George Bush. Both Casey, as a member of Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and Bush, as director of CIA, involved with the genesis of Team B, leading to the Reagan military buildup, the fulfillment of NSC 68, drawn up by Paul Nitze. The Reagan administration comes to power as the result of a covert operation. We saw the agents for Bush when Bush was running to challenge Reagan for the Republican nomination. Eventually, Bush succeeds Reagan. And here again, with the overt and covert operation essentially being combined through activities, we are seeing the ultimate manifestation of the national security state, the synthesis of overt and covert operation, this synthesis heralded by, presaged by, actually directed by Paul Nitze's NSC 68. What we're going to look at next is a very short section of NSC 68, again, this by way of taking a look at the next section, of leading into the next section of tonight's broadcast. Now, in the Doug Henwood article, The Enemy Within, The U.S. Economy, The Enemy Within, another section of NSC 68. Quoting here from Henwood's account, another coercive opportunity, the memo presciently noted, was the wonderfully corrosive potential of nationalism, which could eat away at both the internal stability of the USSR and its relations with its, quote, satellites, unquote. And we're going to take a look at the wonderfully corrosive potential of nationalism and the effects of this overt-slash-covert operation that the last section of the Sean Gervasi article dealt with. We're going to take a look at how this projected into the Soviet Union some of the same individuals and same forces which came over here under the auspices of Galen and related elements, some of the same forces and individuals that we looked at on the Republican Heritage Group's Council, and some of these same elements have since come to the fore in Eastern European nations or segments of the former Soviet Union. That's the next section of tonight's broadcast, but we're going to get to that after a musical break, then more of Radio Free America number 37. We're going to proceed now with the next section of tonight's program, and what we're going to look at now is the destabilization effort inside of the Soviet Union as the fulfillment of NSC 68, the stimulation of the coercive factor of nationalism. And we're going to take a look at another element which has been used by U.S. intelligence, an element which was used by Third Reich intelligence, and which could be considered another element of the Christian West, namely the use of Vatican and Vatican-related elements as proxies for first Third Reich and later U.S. intelligence. And we're going to take a look at an organization now called Intermarium, which was used by Third Reich intelligence against the Soviet Union as a part of the tactics of Rosenberg's Ostministerium. And we're going to take a look then at its use by U.S. intelligence, this by way of foreshadowing the destabilization effort against Poland, the largest non-Soviet member of the old Warsaw Pact. We went into that early last winter in an addendum to Radio Free America 36, and also the use of Catholic-related efforts to promote the resurgence of fascist elements within the Sąjūdis organization, the leading Lithuanian independence organization, and as we looked at in Radio Free America number 36, the cessation of Lithuania threatening the breakaway, which obviously happened, of the Baltic republics, which threatened the Soviet Union's northern flank, as well as the Persian Gulf War, which placed a massive, and as we have seen, as I forecast, and we have seen, a prolonged U.S. military presence on their southern flank, that was a major element in Radio Free, in my working hypothesis of Radio Free America number 36, of provoking a Soviet coup. I'm not going to go into that tactic in detail, but again, Radio Free America 36 entailed as a central element pressure by the U.S. on the northern and southern flanks of the Soviet Union through the stimulation of the breakaway of Lithuania and the resurgence of fascist elements in the Sąjūdis organization of Lithuania, and again, the Persian Gulf War placing an enormous U.S. military presence on the southern flank of the Soviet Union. We're going to return again to the book Blowback by Christopher Simpson, and we're going to focus on a Vatican organization called Inter Mariam, I-N-T-E-R-M-A-R-I-U-M, utilized first by the Third Reich and later by U.S. intelligence. Christopher Simpson writes of this, "Leaders of the Inter Mariam organization became coordinators of much of the Nazi escape effort, that's post-World War II, and many of the men who controlled the Vatican's relief campaign simultaneously became the top leadership of Inter Mariam." By the way, in Radio Free America number 17, we went into the relationship between the Vatican and fascism, and also the utilization by the U.S. intelligence as well as the Galen organization of Vatican-related elements. Continuing with Simpson's account, Monsignor Krunoslav Draganovich, K-R-U-N-O-S-L-O-V-D-R-A-G-O-N-O-V-I-C, who ran escape routes for Ustashi, Croatian fascist fugitives, for example, served as the chief Croatian representative on the self-appointed Inter Mariam ruling council. Archbishop Ivan Buchko, I-V-A-N-B-U-C-H-K-O, of the Ukraine, who successfully intervened with Pope Pius XII himself to win freedom for a Ukrainian Waffen-SS legion, became the senior Ukrainian Inter Mariam representative, according to U.S. Army investigative records obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. The one-time Führer of the openly Nazi Latvian Perkronkrusts, P-E-R-K-O-N-K-R-U-S-T-S, Gustav Selmans, G-U-S-T-A-V-C-E-L-M-I-N-S, was tapped as secretary of the headquarters branch in Rome. One more time. The one-time Führer of the openly Nazi Latvian Perkonkrusts, Gustav Selmans, was tapped as secretary of the headquarters branch in Rome. Declassified U.S. State Department and Army intelligence records trace the roots of Inter Mariam back to an alliance of militantly anti-communist Catholic lay organizations from Eastern Europe established in the mid-1930s. The Abwehr, German military intelligence service, used Inter Mariam contacts as pre-war, quote, agents of influence, unquote, abroad, as well as reasonably reliable sources of information on the large emigre communities of Europe. By the time the Nazis marched across the continent, Inter Mariam had become, in the words of a U.S. Army intelligence report, quote, an instrument of the German intelligence, unquote. Last sentence again. By the time the Nazis marched across the continent, Inter Mariam had become, in the words of a U.S. Army intelligence report, quote, an instrument of the German intelligence, unquote. The name of the group means, quote, between the seas, unquote, and the announced purpose of the coalition was to unite nations, quote, from the Baltic to the Aegean, unquote, in a common front against the USSR. Inter Mariam was also to be the name of a new unified Catholic Federation of all of the countries bordering Russia, a new Holy Roman Empire, in effect, that was to be created in order to hasten the overthrow of the USSR. Although never a fascist or national socialist group as such, Inter Mariam was far to the right of the political spectrum, and a number of its leaders actively collaborated with the Nazis. Their strategy was congruent and in many ways, their strategy was congruent in many important respects with that of Nazi, quote, philosopher, unquote, Alfred Rosenberg, and Intermarium leaders established a close working relationship with the Rosenberg ministry as at least as early as 1940. Again, that last sentence. Their strategy was congruent in many important respects with that of Nazi, quote, philosopher, unquote, Alfred Rosenberg, and Intermarium leaders established a close working relationship with the Rosenberg ministry at least as early as 1940. Centuries-old Catholic anti-Semitism was rife in the organization, and Jews were excluded from Intermarium's federation plan. After the war, Intermarium became one of the first organizations to campaign openly for freedom for Waffen-SS POWs and for permission to establish a volunteer anti-communist army for use in a supposedly imminent war against the USSR. The group's multilingual bulletin, for example, argued as early as January 1947 that, quote, it does not matter whether it is now between a second, beginning again, it does not matter whether it is now between a second and a third world war, or else in the middle of a non-finished second world war, but events should not take us unprepared like in 1939, unquote. Interesting that they said it does not matter whether it's between a second and third world war, an unfinished second world war. Personally, I would opt for this second option. Continuing. Organizing must begin immediately, the official publication asserted, for, unquote, amalgamated common armed forces of the Intermarium, unquote, built out of exiles who had fought on either side between 1939 and 1945. The function of this exile army, in Intermarium's vision, was to deal with the USSR as the Allies had with Germany by, quote, crushing her military strength and partitioning her, unquote, as a key manifesto puts it, quote, into free states in their ethnical borders, unquote. In other words, dividing up the Soviet Union into smaller ethnic units in much the same way as had been proposed by the Rosenberg Group inside the German High Command. I would interject, obviously, that has since happened. Skipping down. By the way, the Gowan here is a U.S. Counterintelligence Corps Special Agent William Gowan, G-O-W-E-N. Gowan and other CIC agents established a working relationship with a number of Intermarium officials that same year, that's 1947. Their immediate goal was to create trouble for the Soviet-aligned government in Hungary, which had deposed a pro-Western prime minister in mid-1947. Not long after the Intermarium escape incident, Agent Gowan arranged with intelligence specialists at the U.S. Department of State to provide a U.S. diplomatic visa to a leading Intermarium spokesman, Ferenc Vajda, Ferenc Vajda, so that he might travel to America. Vajda's mission for Intermarium and for the CIC was to convince the deposed prime minister, Ferenc Nagy, F-E-R-E-N-C, capital N-A-G-Y, to join with former Axis Quislings in a new U.S.-sponsored alliance against communist power in Hungary. Well, Vajda, Simpson goes on to explain, was a former member of the Arrow Cross, like Laszlo Pastor, and he was eventually able to convince Ferenc Nagy, actually that's pronounced Nagy Ferenc in Hungarian, to jump to the U.S., although he later denounced Vajda. Interestingly enough, Ferenc Nagy, or Nagy Ferenc, became a member of the board of directors of the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, or Permandex. That was the CIA organization, another of whose directors was Clay Shaw, the principal defendant in Jim Garrison's investigation of the JFK assassination in New Orleans, another member of the board of directors of CMC with Nagy here, was a fellow named H. Simon Fay, S-I-M-O-N-F-A-Y, another Hungarian, who was the director of an Italian subsidiary of the ACEN, another CIA-financed organization which served as a repository for many of these same Galen elements. Now note here that Intermarium had basically pursued the same policies before, during, and after World War II, as the Rosenberg minister, Ostministerium, namely the partition of the Soviet Union into smaller ethnic republics. It worked, according to a U.S. Army report, intelligence report, as an agent of German intelligence. It later obviously began working with the United States. This by way of, again, taking a look at a tactic that was utilized by Third Reich intelligence and later adopted by U.S. intelligence, which obviously adopted many of the same tactics as Third Reich intelligence vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and the use of Vatican and Vatican-related elements as a vehicle for destabilizing the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union is something we're going to look at right now.